2 here, uses or threatens the immediate use of a dangerous weapon. Now, in burglary, we say, uses or threatens the immediate use of a dangerous instrument. Here we say weapon. Shouldn't they be uniform?
Yeah, I agree. I think they should be weapons. But, I thought we'd settled on weapons.
Crowbar.
Well, I don't think that, frankly, at this point, that whether we use instrument or weapon is going to make a whole lot of difference, because those terms don't have to be defined.
It's going to make the definition even more simple.
They should be uniform.
If they're the same, and we're meaning the same thing.
No, I think you're right that this should conform with what we have there already, and because as we pointed out when we were going over our burglary drafts, that the term dangerous weapon or dangerous instrument had not yet been defined by the commission. Although I think we all have a general idea of what the type of weapon we're talking about.
My offhand thought, in view of the multiplicity of decisions defining dangerous and deadly weapons, would be that it would be better to have it as weapon than instrument, even in burglary.
Mm-hmm.
Because an instrument becomes a weapon with the use of it.
Yeah,
that's true. Well, in other words, you want to amend the burglary draft to
Make change instruments to weapons. Well, do you see anything wrong with that?
Well, what would you think of this? Could we just hold off on doing that until we see what's going to be proposed with respect to definition of some of these terms? Because that's one of the terms that's going to be defined in our preliminary articles.
You mean instrument or weapon?
Yeah, that's could we, in order to make it consistent, in as much as we've already approved the burglary draft, so that we don't have to go back and revise that again, and then later have to revise it again to conform with what might be decided by the commission with respect to an overall definition of these terms. What would you think, to be uniform, we just employ instrument in this draft, or leave it the way it is for that matter, but we could make it consistent later on. But what I'm trying to do is avoid another revision of a draft that's already been approved by the subcommittee.
That's all right with me. You be sure and make a note of that and jog our memory over there. Because they should be brought into conformity with each other, I think.
In order to be consistent, we could change this to instrument now in this draft, and that way this would be consistent with what we use in the burglary draft.
I think
weapon. You know, I'm thinking here, and I hate to be bringing up all these things and taking time, but we've got the situation now with armed robbery, where the decisions say that if there's a presumption, if you have a gun, there's a presumption that the gun is loaded. There's no evidence to the contrary brought up by the defendant, then the evidence simply that he had a gun is going to be sufficient to sustain the indictment for armed robbery. Other hand, the defendant takes a stand, says the gun wasn't loaded. Judge Gleason, he can reduce it, or the jury can, the judge could reduce it, actually, if he wanted to, I guess. Maybe it's a question of fact. But what I'm getting at is this. The way we're rearranging this isn't in any sense going to affect any of the decisions that we have defining these terms.
we're using language that has already been defined by the courts.
Yeah, in the context of these different degrees of robbery. Don, where does evidence shows that he had a gun? I'm assuming that the presumption still attaches that it's loaded. Therefore, it's a deadly weapon and it'll be robbery in the first degree, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. What if he shows that the gun was inoperable or the gun wasn't loaded? Is it still robbery in the first degree? Because it isn't a deadly weapon anymore, and he couldn't use or threaten the immediate use of a dangerous weapon if it wasn't, in fact, a dangerous weapon.
Well, he could threaten to.
But if it wasn't a dangerous weapon, could he threaten
to? He wouldn't have to even be talking about that particular weapon.
Well, yeah, it would be difficult to envision a court, even in the absence of any statutory definition of a dangerous weapon, to hold that a gun was not a dangerous, certainly at least not a dangerous weapon.
Not something which you could threaten as being dangerous, the fact that you show it as a threat to use a dangerous weapon. Or the fact that you show a cat gun that looks like a real business.
It's the fear in the mind of the victim that's the deadly thing. So what we're doing is we're putting assault with intent to rob, robbery by fear, or putting robbery by putting in fear, not being armed, and armed robbery all in the same statute. Okay. Are there other questions with respect to robbery in the first degree?
No.
Ready to vote on the preliminary draft number one as to rock.
Yes.
Okay. A motion to adopt it as amended.
That's what.
Okay. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Okay. Pass. Where do we go now?
Okay. We have one other section which follows. Commentary on robbery. That is a section on claim of right and not a defense. It's on page 8 of the material. It is not a defense against a prosecution for robbery in either of its degrees that there was no theft because the taking of the property was under a claim of right. This section is adapted from Michigan Code Section 3310. The reason being that since claim of right is a defense to a charge of theft, and since robbery occurs in the course of committing a theft, a claim of right would probably be available against a robbery charge on the theory that there was no theft unless the statutes provide to the contrary. I think that that's a good reason to have it in there. I think claim of right, when you start talking about the use of force and violence, I think that the criminal law, should not encourage people to engage in violent activity, even if they feel it's under claim of right.
Produces a kind of totality of reasoning, doesn't it?
Sure does.
Committing a theft, but this is not actually, this is actually a theft because it was under claim of right. In a sense, what the person be prosecuted for in those cases is some kind of assault,
yeah,
really, rather than robbery, and yet you're still saying it's robbery, even though it isn't a theft.
And even though it's his stuff.
Of course, we've already said that there it could be a robbery even though there's no theft, if it's in the course of an attempt or a
I meant not mistaking that. This would be one in which the prosecution for theft would not lie because he has a good defense.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it can't be robbery. That's what I'm
getting at.
Yeah, right.
It can be robbery if somebody's got my automobile and won't give it back and they threaten with use of a dangerous weapon, or I have some other guy go with me to take that car away from him. It belongs to me. I should kill him for robbery.
That's exactly what it is. Anti-self-help.
That's right. That's going quite a ways, isn't it?
Claim a right is a defense to theft.
Yeah.
Yeah, but not to robbery.
If robbery occurs in the course of committing the theft.
Or attempt.
What's critical on that, please? I mean, not that. Do we have any such provision?
Mm-hmm. No, that's.
Has it been a problem?
No.
Well, I a guy's got a right to leave them, to take a reasonable course to protect his own property.
You don't get his property, it's something else.
I suppose what we're saying is that if you've got a claim of right and you can reclaim this property and you can do it peaceably, you're all right. But if you don't, then you run the danger of being prosecuted.
Or even to retain the immediate. The guy who was retaining the possession of it. After you're taking it back, what belongs to him?
I think there's a good policy reason for encouraging people to use lawful processes.
I do too.
To recover property or, you know, get redress in a lawful manner.
Well, I do too, but I've had some experiences.
And certainly under the laws that exist today, I mean, you wouldn't be privileged to go to reclaim your property and use a loaded revolver to do it.
Because you're going to get
in another trouble along the way. You're going to be into assault trouble and things like that.
Well, I'm thinking of maybe a couple of hillbillies that live back 75 miles from town and never heard of a lawyer that doesn't know the lawyer. Has the idea that it would cost them $1,000 to build it. Reclaim $100 worth of property, are going to use
self-help. They come to the front door and they say, we want our property back, and my God, we better have it back. Or else. And they're the two of them are, and that constitutes a robbery, actually. And they're just going after own property. It's hard. I have to think about that a while.
Well, that flies exactly in the face of the section on defenses that we have to theft, particularly in view of the fact that we define robbery as a person acting in the course of committing or attempting to commit a theft, doesn't it? Because what you're saying, as you brought up earlier, that person doesn't commit theft if he acts under an honest claim of right in that he's unaware that the property is that of another, or he reasonably believes he's entitled to the property or has a right to acquire or dispose of it. Now, those are irrevocably locked to theft.
I would be a lot better satisfied with this if we put a period after the word theft back here. And left off the rest of it.
What?
In this act, there was no theft.
Yeah, period.
Now, wait a minute. Why wouldn't you just strike the whole section?
Because we want to be able to convict him of robbery even though he didn't accomplish the theft. And we want to say that specifically someplace. This would be saying it.
In view of your amendment to second degree robbery, you would have to say no theft or attempted theft.
Yeah, why do we need this? If the robbery section over here says what they mean.
Because presumably people would come in right along and say that was my property. I had a perfect right to be there. I imagine Jerry's turned loose elsewhere.
Well, if it was my...
If it's true, it probably should be.
As I understand it from you, one of your thoughts in this is to discourage people from taking the law into their own hands. Which is another concept.
But we say, do you commit robbery if in the course of committing or attempting to commit theft?
Yeah.
You do thus or so. And we've also said that you don't commit theft if you act under an honest claim of right.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So,
okay.
I go in.
You can
call. Is there a phone nowhere?
I don't know.
Okay. Yeah, I'd say
half hour. It won't be longer. It won't be longer than half hour.
Yeah, okay.
So, you don't commit theft if you act under an honest claim of right. So that hillbilly that comes in, that's my property, he's not committing theft. He couldn't be prosecuted by theft if he went into the barn and took it. If he honestly believed it was his own, then he could show that it was his own. By the same token, he wouldn't be committing robbery if he came up to the house and pulled a gun. He might be committing assault.
Yeah, which he can be taken care of on some other...
Well, it certainly would if he offered violence.
Sure.
He'd be committing assault.
Sure, but that's not what we're talking about here.
Well, yeah.
His answer would be, I ain't no thief because it can't be no robbery.
But here's where we skirt the... Here's where we skirt the deep water by separating robbery from assault. But, in another sense, but do you see the problem, Don?
Well, I see it. I'm not sure that I appreciate its significance, but...
you want to discourage that hillbilly from...
Well, I once had a case where one hillbilly shot another hillbilly over by the rocks of the road.
That wasn't the high noon case.
That was the high noon case.
They were a little bit... They were more sophisticated than hillbilly.
I don't think we should even inferentially say that it's okay to commit robbery under a claim of right. That's what I'm saying. I think as a statement of public policy, I don't think that even inferentially by omission that we should be able to read robbery and then look at theft and say this is what theft is, but it's not theft if you have a claim of right.
I'm sorry you brought it up at all. Because you've mentioned it to two other lawyers here in the room now. I think it's going to be you, so.
Well,
because, I mean, this hillbilly hypothetical is fine, but you're going to get situations where this victim may not be somebody who's gone over and taken this property. I mean, you're not necessarily talking about reclaiming property from a thief. You're talking about a dispute between two people over who has title to a piece of property. And so this guy is under an honest claim of right. He thinks that the victim has no right to his property. They get into a dispute. He says, okay, so he pulls a gun on him or he pulls a weapon and he says, this is my property and I'm going to take it.
And he's committed a lot of the crimes.
And he's committed assault.
Yeah.
But maybe he's committed robbery too, because there may be a real question as to whose property that is.
But then the facts will come out as to whose property really is. And then the theft will be established, right?
But he could still have an honest claim of right, even though that it might show that that's his claim of right is mistaken.
If there's a solid policy reason for preventing that, there, by the same token, is a solid policy reason for making it unlawful for a guy to go into somebody else's woodshed and steal something under a claim of right. The rationale is the same. Trying to encourage the purported owner of the property to reclaim it by peaceful or civil means rather than taking the law into his own hands. So
there's one added feature though, and that's in this case the use or the threatened use of violence. And I think that if the rationale of our robbery article is going to be the suppression of violent means to take property, that the claim of right should not be a defense to a charge of robbery. Just goes against my grain.
It goes against my grain to if you assume that the guy has a legitimate claim of right to then put all of the sanctions of robbery on his enforcing that legitimate claim of right.
Well, how about making a distinction between a factual claim, a claim of right that proves to be correct, and a claim of right that's just a false claim? If you make that distinction, I'd be able to go along with
it. Well,
because the fellow actually owns the property.
Even if. I'm sorry.
I think that's the truth.
No, well, what you're saying, even if he does own it, by golly, he still shouldn't use violent means to reclaim it.
I guess that's essentially what I'm saying.
Well, he can't use violent means to reclaim his property anyway, because he's guilty of several crimes, just by virtue of doing so.
You know, I think we all agree that, you know, we all agree that we should prohibit the use of force here. But where my problem is, saying that it's not a defense here flies in the face of theft, which says that it is a defense. You follow me?
Mm-hmm.
Now, this possibly could be remedied if we would put an appendage on this section and say the defense is applicable to theft in section 25 herein are not applicable to robbery or something like that.
Well, isn't that basically what I've said?
No, I don't think so.
Well, how does it work in theft? Do you have to have a valid claim of right in order to make that
an honest claim of right?
You
what you're concerned with. Well, you're not really concerned with the validity of the claim. You're concerned with the state of mind of the actor. In other words, was he acting under an honest belief that he had a right to this property, or did he have an intent to steal it?
In which case, if he honestly thinks it's his, he couldn't have had the intention to try to
steal the property. See, it might prove it. It might be later shown that this was a completely mistaken idea that he had.
But that is a defense for that.
Sure.
Because he didn't have the intention of taking someone else's property. That was taking his own. It would help his case probably if his claim had some was reasonable and not just some wild imaginary thing he had dreamed up.
It isn't a defense that will necessarily work, is it?
If somebody had stolen your kid's bicycle, and you see somebody park a bicycle down here that looks to you identical with your kid's bicycle, and you take it home to your kid, you're not guilty of theft if you thought that was his bicycle.
No.
But you might be fixed for it in the meantime.
But you might not be able to sue the person who had possession and recover on the basis of it. I mean, it might not support a civil suit, but it was reasonable and honest in its.
Could I read to you what the thinking of the Michigan drafters was on this question of claim of right here? It says, as indicated earlier, at least two Michigan decisions state that a claim of right to the property taken is a defense against a charge of robbery. Now that, they have case law on that. We don't. This flows logically from the traditional definition of robbery as in effect largely by assault. Now the Oregon cases have defined robbery in essentially the same terms. It's an open, violent larceny. A claim of right means that there is no larceny, so that in turn, and as a matter of logic, there can be no robbery. Only the assault can be punished. Since robbery under their section here of the draft occurs in the course of committing or attempting to commit theft, since claim of right is a defense to a charge of theft, a claim of right would also be available as defense unless a contrary doctrine is indicated. However, the chief concern in Chapter 33, which is their robbery chapter, is for the protection of the lives and physical and mental well-being of citizens. Therefore, there is little point in retaining the common law defense, since the danger to the citizen from the use or threat of force is present no matter what the origin of the claim by the defendant to the property may be. There is an added policy in favor of non-retention of the defense, namely that citizens should be encouraged to assert their property rights through orderly processes of law rather than by force. The draft, therefore, in Section 3310 specifically eliminates the claim of right as a defense to robbery in any of its degrees. In taking this position, the draft does not, in fact, decree punishment of those who, under present law, would be innocent of crime. It only affects the character of criminality and perhaps the maximum term of imprisonment, and that under existing doctrine, the defendant would be convicted of an aggravated form of assault despite his claim of right, while under the draft he's punished for robbery in one of his degrees is originally charged in the information. So, I rest my case.
Well, I can't go for convicting a guy of robbery under any circumstances if he actually owned the property that he was trying to get. And
supposing he didn't actually own the property, but he thought he did. He honestly believed he did. Would you believe that he could be convicted then?
No, if he honestly believed he did. What robbery is life imprisonment.
What do we have now in Oregon, right now? We have no such statute as this. John Jones is indicted for robbery. He testifies in his own defense that he went to reclaim this property. He honestly believed it was his own. Person that had possession of it resisted him, and he employed force to retrieve it, successfully did retrieve it. Now, the court, he's entitled to an instruction. The court is going to instruct the jury what?
And he had a right to use reasonable force under those circumstances. If he used more force than it was reasonable, if he would shoot somebody or commit an act which obviously would commit great harm to that person, I would think the jury would say that was unreasonable.
Well, now wait, the reasonable force instruction goes to the crime of assault.
I know.
Not to the crime of robbery.
I know that. And I'm putting it on the basis of assault.
So presently, He could be charged with assault and found guilty if it was found that he employed more force than was reasonably necessary.
He might be found guilty of assault with a dangerous weapon, which is quite a serious crime.
Generally, you think of this in terms, or that instruction in terms of self-defense, or self-preservation of property rather than the retrieving of property.
Yeah, well, I remember a long time ago prosecuting a guy for shooting another fellow in the arm with a .22 who was trespassing on the defendant's land, and he had a hell of an argument with a jury and finally convicted him of using more force than was reasonably necessary because of a trespasser who wasn't really doing any harm to him.
I can't see any. I can't see any problem with our present system.
Well, you do leave quite a hole in this statute, but I guess there's one already, isn't there? There's a great big hole right now. Yeah, but no one has chosen to use it.
Yeah, there aren't any Oregon cases on this claim of right to a robbery charge that I know.
Going to be a rash of cases in the Portland area now.
Well, that's because robbery has always been stealing by force.
Stealing.
Now, under this, it isn't.
Well, yeah, of course, Robbery's always been the same thing under Michigan law, and they have two cases, two reported cases, to say that the claim of right is a defense. Under the common law, claim of right. Not statutory claim of right. And we do have a common law claim of right as a defense to larceny under our present law.
Yeah, well, how often is it used and how successfully? Apparently not very often.
No.
Not very successfully.
And same way here, I don't think this is something that would coming up every day. You know, I mean, this is going to be an unusual situation, but I mean, I felt more than having it in there for practical application as a policy section, thing to have. Because this kind of situation it's going to be very unusual, if not unique, to have a prosecution under that kind of a fact situation.
Practically never.
And I retract the earlier statement that I made that you were going to have to negate the applicability of the theft offenses because they are negated here by this, if not by the statutory language, certainly by your commentary, which is soon going to be known as Paulette's Law. Well, what's the wish?
As modified, but something.
Well, I think it's a substantive policy question. In general.
You're hillbilly hypothetical. I mean, any DA can go to trial or something like that.
Well, we had then we had some litigation afterwards trying to take a tax deduction for the expense of defense, and we had a lot of expert testimony on what the mores of Grant County were, and using self-help under those circumstances, and that was therefore a usual and ordinary business expense. The trial court went with us, and the Supreme Court is pretty personal.
That case made Time Magazine, as I recall.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Is that right? Made Time Magazine?
Yeah. High noon.
But, you know, with that kind of situation, Ed, it'd be sort of like prosecuting all the fellas out of Bonita on Saturday night for assault and battery. All of them getting a fight out there.
Well,
I'm very wishy-washy in this.
I think we should discourage robberies. And if this section here is going to discourage people from resorting to violent means under a claim of right, then I'm for it. And I'm sure it's going to provoke some discussion by the full commission. But the only reason I have any hesitancy in voting for it is Paulette's got his way on damn near everything.
All right. We have a motion. I don't care.
Well, here in your office, and some guy comes in and says to you, my neighbor's got my horse and won't give it back. Do I have a right to go get it? Or must I pay you $100 for a reclaiming action? Well, I think that I only have a right to tell that guy you can go get it, but you only have a right to use whatever force is necessary and is reasonable.
You could advise him, you could have a little written sheet and say, you have a right to go there and tempestuously take it. But if you meet with resistance, you can't get in a fight or use any force. That's the way our law is, if we would adopt it.
If he doesn't get off his place, he has to retreat and get off his place.
So, what?
I think we should wait and see.
Yeah, but how about the innocent stakeholder? You know, you're not talking about the situation that's always going to be where A takes from B and B goes back to try to reclaim from A. You're going to have A takes from B and sells it to C, and then B goes to C, and C thinks he's got a right to keep this property. As far as he's concerned, this is just as much robbery by A as it would be by anybody else.
That's true.
And the guy comes in and beats him up or pulls a gun, and any number of things can happen. And they both have, as far as their individual states of mind at the time were concerned, they both have a claim of right to this thing. And I mean, it's that type of situation where, as far as this victim's concerned, he comes in to see the district attorney, and he's all beaten and bloody, and he said, God, I bought this horse last week, and now this guy comes over, and he wants the horse, and I wouldn't give it to him, so he and two other guys beat me up. What are you going to do about it? You're going to say, well, there's nothing I can do about that because he has, you know.
You can charge him an aggravated assault. You can charge him an aggravated assault or a DA with the assault.
Yeah, sure. It's still assault. Sure, I would agree that it could still
be. I don't want to make robbery out of it.
I used to tell those guys it was a civil problem.
Because it isn't a civil problem, but it is a face plate.
I can see that this could provide, if a lot of the defense attorneys start using it, I suppose they're, you know, the great bulk of these robbery cases, though, are banks, taverns, little grocery stores, and so on, and there isn't any question they're cut and dry.
Oh, sure.
It's very seldom that any defendant who has been prosecuted has any chance to make any substantial showing of a claim of ownership.
He went in the grocery store and he held him up the gun.
Sell the
devil. Yeah. What we've been talking about is some real unusual case.
The fight that occur, or the where property's involved, generally in a civil prosecution.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's that.
Yeah, right. And I think what Michigan's attitude has been in their draft there is that they recognize it would still be an assault, but they feel that there may be instances where it should be more severe than assault.
Or assault with a dangerous weapon.
Well, of course, this
assault with an attempt to get great bodily harm seems to me would get those cases.
That certainly makes this, closes up a major opening in the thing. If you put this in there, then it sure closes it up airtight.
Well,
is it
right? No, we have to make a decision on this. I'm a little bit, less disposed to make a decision on it now than I was an hour ago. It is not a defense against the prosecution for robbery in either of its degrees that there was no theft, because the taking of the property was under a claim of right. It's not a defense against the prosecution for robbery that there was no theft, because the taking of the property was under a claim of right. In other words, as a defense, I cannot assert as a defense that I perpetrated this theft.
I would go along if you would make that if there was no theft or intended theft.
Well, explain again why you feel that because of taking the property was under a claim of right, it should be deleted.
Because it goes against my brain to say that the guy doesn't have that. In that particular situation, the right to use some force or make some threats in order to get his own property back.
Assuming that it was his property. Assuming that it was his property.
Yeah, and we're saying here that it's robbery, even though it was.
Not a defense against a prosecution for robbery in either of the degrees if there's no theft or intended theft. And theft, of course, is a
sure good you're an actor now.
I got those from Miller money.
That's when he takes, appropriates, obtains, or withholds property from an owner thereof. Well, by golly, there's one thing that is for sure, and that is if we don't have this end, the theft offenses are going to be raised.
Yes, and this, and this specifically says, the way I suggest the advice there, that you don't have to be...
But it'll be obviously a pack of lies in the jury.
Would we have to any kind of equal protection thing there, that what we really have done to this person is to say, we're convicting you of robbery carrying a potential of life imprisonment, even though the only facts we showed in the prosecution was that you're guilty of assault, or aggravated assault, or whatever. Because we have shown that you really didn't, I mean, it's not...
Yeah, that might be a little dangerous thing.
Yeah, all right.
I move we suspend consideration just for one meeting.
Well, wait a minute. Before I entertain that motion, this is all that we're hanging up on, and assuming that we complete consideration of this, of what we've had today, and do I understand that the next meeting will be a full commission meeting, within the next month to consider everything that has been done?
Yeah, I'd like to get together with the chairman and...
within the next couple of weeks?
Yeah, and schedule a commission meeting as soon as possible.
All right. Well, with that in mind, Ed, we're not going to have another subcommittee meeting.
Well, my intent is...
Well, I think I'll go back and suggest that period after Sabbath.
That confuses me too much.
Well, because on the robbery...
I don't know what you're doing.
On the robbery thing, in the course of committing a theft or attempting theft, he does these things, he's still the robber, but he doesn't have to succeed in the theft. Is what we're trying to specifically say. And that's why my last suggestion of or intended theft is no good.
Should it be attempted?
No, I think it does have to be attempted theft in order to make a robbery. In the course of committing a theft or attempted theft. That he didn't succeed in.
It's not
favorite.
What you're saying there is it's not a defense if the defendant says, look, I'm not guilty of robbery because I didn't carry off either a theft or an attempted theft.
No, I did it. I'm not really a robber because I didn't succeed in getting the stuff.
Right.
But I did.
So you're circumventing the entire purpose of this his purpose is saying that it's not a defense if you claim that you owned it and went out and you employed force to get it.
That's right, because I don't want that thing. I am circumventing the statute as being making robbery the use of self-help if you've got a reasonable right to do it. Otherwise.
Well, let me ask you this before I put your motion up. Do you agree that if we don't have something here to negate the applicability of the theft offenses, we're going to open up we're going to open this wide open. Because every, not every defendant, but a substantial number are going to say that theft wasn't committed because
he had a right,
right to the property.
I certainly didn't mean to imply that I thought there was going to be this horrible
Pandora's box.
You know, the parade of the horribles and all this, where everybody's going to. I don't think you're going to have, even with claim of right under our theft statute, I don't certainly anticipate that we're going to have any more claim of right defenses than we ever have had under larceny prosecutions.
There's no hardly ever that you ever legitimate claim of right.
And I would venture to say that the reason you don't find many claim of right larceny cases on the books is because those kind of cases never go to trial in the first place.
Yeah.
All right.
Mr. Chairman.
All right.
That motion made all sure. I move that the section robbery claim of right not defense be made on the table.
Okay. The move that we lay the robbery defense section on the table. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Opposed. Lay on the table. That completes the meeting for today. Meeting adjourned.
July 13th, 1968, subcommittee number 1, discussing arson and reckless burning.
To confer with Senator Turi on that.
Brother Mark was coming in. You asked me something wonderfully enough. If I was coming in, they were horrible. If I wasn't, he'd have to come. I said, I was coming in. I couldn't guarantee anybody else's
attendance. Spalding is down in Roseburg trying that Oxbow fire for the show.
He's going to be tied up. Yeah, he told us before.
Yeah, well, he had told us that. And what
Saturday, August,
July was going to be a bad
month. We're defending his suit. He should be an expert on reckless burning.
Yeah, it's, well, we can get his expertise later.
That's all right. I can get back on Saturday.
I'm going to call the meeting to order. There is a quorum, but what I think we'll do is we'll go ahead and proceed through the preliminary draft of the one on arson, and if we make some progress with respect to it, we can ask the subcommittee and expect the meeting to review and ratify what we've done today, and I think that way we can most effectively utilize our time. Before we do, though, particularly because some of you weren't here at the last meeting, I'd like Don just to briefly review what we did on robbery. The minutes have already gone out, and I assume you received them, and I won't move for their approval because we don't have a sufficient number, but we did really make some progress in criminal mischief and robbery, and without opening it up to discussion, we'll just let him review it now. And
June 22nd.
Yes, yes.
This is much, much better.
Now, our latest draft on criminal mischief, which is preliminary draft number 3, is the one that will be submitted to the full commission next week on the 19th. One of the articles for consideration at that time by the commission. The draft on criminal mischief really embodies the elements of an earlier draft that had been designated as criminal tampering. The first section really is criminal tampering or unlawful interference with the property of another that does not result in any damage to the property. The other two sections 2 and 3 of that draft, deal with what we would traditionally think of as malicious mischief or malicious destruction. robbery draft that was approved will be submitted also to the full commission, and that will appear as preliminary draft number two. We also will be submitting, although these were not considered at the last meeting, but we have now articles that have been considered and approved by subcommittee number one, in addition to criminal mischief and robbery. We have the article on burglary, which will go to the commission. The article on theft of services, unauthorized use of vehicles, and
criminal
tampering was out. No, that one was.
So that's right. That
was tabled. Yeah, I think that's pretty much it. But burglary and criminal trespass. That was the other one.
Burglary, criminal trespass, robbery, taking and using, criminal mischief, theft of services. Right. We'll have a real full meeting Friday.
Now, all of you, I think, received a notification in the mail, but following the meeting on the 19th, the commission meeting on the 19th, we'll have subcommittee number three will meet on the 20th. That's Neil Harlan's subcommittee. And they will be considering the first preliminary draft prepared by Courtney Arthur on classes of crimes. And I hope that we'll have a substantial turnout of the membership for the commission meeting, because at that time on the 19th, we'll attempt to schedule a subsequent subcommittee meeting for subcommittee number three to take up the first draft that's been prepared by George Platt on responsibility. Three sections of the responsibility article are now ready. And of course, the most important one is the insanity defense section of that draft.
Where? If I remember correctly, though, we're only serving on one subcommittee.
Yes.
It isn't like some of these.
Yes. None of the members on this committee have any responsibilities on the other subcommittees. But
well, I assume
we're afraid of.
But although you'll be informed as well on what the drafts are, what that subcommittee has under consideration.
I just didn't want to put the Senate Committee on anybody else.
No.
Because of
so we'll have, we have a pretty full month in the schedule, and I would anticipate that August will also be a busy month. I would like to see us get as many of the drafts that are coming out of the law schools now during the summer, when both Plant and Arthur have more time to vote for this, and get these drafts before the subcommittees as soon as possible.
And one other thing that which some of you might not be aware is that Senator Terry and Don, I guess, appeared in front of the emergency board last month, and they authorized some more money. I don't know whether you knew that ball or whether you knew that just as well. So we have authorization to hire an additional attorney. And Don is presently interviewing, as I understand it. Now, we did approve robbery as it appears in preliminary draft number one. There were some amendments to that, and as I understand it, Mildred, that will be coming out in the mail this week, is that right? Can I ask this question? Did everybody today, everybody here today, receive their preliminary draft on arson?
Yes.
I did.
Yes, he did.
I did not.
I did not. But that
called yesterday afternoon, so
that's,
I can understand why he didn't.
It's book number 11.
That's right. Yes. All right, let's go on into arson and reckless burning.
Have you had a chance to see this at all? No. It's all, we're all cold.
Well, that'll kind of equalize. Yes.
Well, yeah, that's true.
I just sit here in amazement when I look at this guy Tanner and his knowledge of criminal law.
Well, just before we get into the details of preliminary draft number one, just a brief summary of the approach here and what the section's done. We have a definition section, and then we have two ascending degrees of arson, and then a article which, rather than being called arson in the third degree, has been designated as reckless burning because it does not concern itself with the intentional type of arson. Well, they could fall in that, although, and I would expect that that's one part of this graph is going to see quite a bit of discussion, the way in which I have handled the question of intentional starting a forest fire. Because we get into it, it won't seem as much a departure from our present law as my first reading. But starting off with the first section on definitions, subsection 1, the definition of building is the same as the definition that we have in the burglary and criminal trespass article, as it appears in the preliminary draft number 2. Of course, the intent there, what we're trying to accomplish, is the same basically as we did in the burglary draft, and that's to include structures and other vehicles that fall within the definition of building, as we define it, that usually contain human beings in them for extended periods of time. And of course, the fundamental purpose and the basic rationale of the crime of arson is to protect human safety. This definition, as it was in the burglary article, is taken from the model penal code, or the medical penal code rather, and it's quite similar to the definitions in the model penal code of the New York draft. Now, the separate units part of the definition of building, for example, shows that an apartment is a building in itself and also a collection of buildings. And the model penal code refers to it as an occupied structure of another. The definition is quite similar, as you'll see as we get into their sections that we set out here.
Why are we going to get into the problem of creating, maybe not creating, but the problem of multiple offenses is a serious one, I think, and it really hasn't been tackled very well in Oregon, except by custom.
You mean where a person
sets fire to an apartment house, for example, and then somebody brings it, as it's a 12-year apartment house, and somebody brings 12 charges against it.
Well, I don't know of anybody in that situation. I think the dwelling house. Well, I don't ever know any prosecution
no, but I know of some prosecutions have been attempted anyway, in counties of the guy who drives a car too fast up to the bank, sticks up the bank, shoots somebody on the way out, bumps into a car on the way away, and so forth and so on. And this, and there have been in the past, not very many recently, in the last 5 or 6 years, some attempts to keep going down until they can convict a guy.
Well, to do this,
multiple prosecutors
have to be looking like Richard Nixon.
Face. All you have to do is mention that name and I quoted it.
They do this habitually in Multnomah County and a lot of the other counties, double barreling a guy in an effort to get him to plead to one of the charges. And I don't, you know, for example, he might have burglarized a construction company office and stole a bunch of checks, forged the checks, and passed the checks. They might get them for burglary, forgery, uttering, and maybe even obtaining. And
I don't mind it at the pleading stage. I don't mind it at the initial stage. I don't mind the grand jury bringing four indictments of them, but I don't want to get in a situation where the district attorney can lose case number one and then just keep going on down the line until he comes up with a conviction.
Well, why did he steal it and the jury made a mistake when they acquitted him first, second, third time? So I think he should be...
Well, the system assumes that the jury doesn't make mistakes. I mean, the system assumes that all witnesses tell the truth, all women are chaste, and the jury don't make mistakes, and that all our lawyers are of equal ability, and all these things. And I think that we've got to assume the system works right if we start picking the blame or create it.
I think you're talking about an extension of Jeopardy.
Really?
That's right.
How many times do you have the prosecutor carving out a point transaction?
Right.
Yeah, this is the thing that bothers
me. It seems to me that this is a fertile area, really.
It is.
It's a tremendously fertile area. And I would think that the Subcommittee on General Articles would delve into this, particularly in as much as a professor and not a prosecutor is doing the drafting of that subcommittee. Would you agree, Don?
Yeah, I'm sure.
Jack did want to raise it somewhere along the line.
I think it's a valid point, Bob, and I've recently seen two or three instances where defense attorneys have applied for an injunction against the district attorney's office for continuing to prosecute the same person after he was acquitted on a related charge. Court, in its wisdom, didn't take jurisdiction of it. It's something that
has to be. It's going to create a problem for district attorney. He's going to have to go down to the offense that he's sure he can get a conviction on.
What do they do in the federal system where you can join?
They make them join everything that's in the same related series of acts.
Sure. And then you're through.
And then you're through.
Yeah.
And then you just stop. And then you go around. You can't go back and pick up something else.
You can try it for four offenses in the same trial and put it before the same jury.
Mm-hmm.
But if you lose out on all four of them, why, you're dead.
Do you do that on counts, I wonder?
On counts.
Yeah. But
I was in the U.S. Attorney's Office for few years, but I've forgotten now.
They have more liberal joinder than we do.
Mandatory joinder.
And I think this is something that we've got to come to in our revision efforts, and I believe, and believed all along, that this procedural part is going to be a lot harder than the substantive stuff we're doing now. You know,
I agree.
Well, anyway, let's hustle on there.
All right.
I have questions, but where are you?
See, we were on sub two, yeah.
Building of another?
Building of another means building a property in which anyone other than the act of accessory or proprietary interest, these come from a lot of people.
20.1. May I get back to sub 1?
Yes.
I am offended where it says includes any vehicle, boat, aircraft, or other structure. Now, a vehicle, boat, or aircraft is not a structure.
Sure. Well, looking at the.
But I'm wondering if you'd say, or a structure.
Either that or put includes any vehicle, boat, or aircraft at the end.
This is the same definition that we had in the definitional sections on burglary, which are in the book. But I noticed in looking at the definition in the arson section of our current code, which is 164.010. It's that it uses the expression dwelling house. It says any building, railroad car, house trailer, house, boat, or other structure is a dwelling house within the meaning of this chapter, if any part of it has usually been occupied by any person lodging therein. Now, I suppose in that context, using railroad car, boat, well, you omit railroad car, you include boat. They don't have vehicle, nor do they have aircraft.
Certain railroad cars would be covered under this.
I would assume.
Work crew cars.
A Pullman car.
It wouldn't cover a freight car, which is occupied by a hobo. It's not adapted.
Well, this is where you run into a problem on this, is whether or not the other requires that this vehicle, motor aircraft, be adapted to overnight accommodation. And I assume that it's not intended to be meant that way. That Bob's airplane is not adapted for overnight accommodation, yet to burn it.
Would be ours.
Actually, if you change it to read something along this line, building in addition to its ordinary meaning includes any other structure adapted for overnight accommodation of persons or for carrying on business therein, comma, or any vehicle, boat, or aircraft, mm-hmm. then you might get the same.
But what we were trying to get at here was to include the types of structures that would have people in
these house cars
or would be likely to have.
Well, now, wait a minute.
Don't we cover property in sub 2 down here? I mean, I assume you're getting at, Don, is that a lodging, the burning of a lodging is going to be a higher degree of arson than the burning of another type of property.
Yes, sir.
And so in one, you're talking about the burning of the lodging, and in two, property of another, which anyone has a possession or proprietary interest, that would be Bob's airplane, which isn't adapted for overnight, right?
Yeah.
So then, doesn't that render the point?
Well, they don't burn when I'm in it off the ground.
But I think these definitions, as we see how they're utilized in the subsequent sections of the definitions of crime, you get a better idea of what we're driving at. As far as subsection 1, certainly that can be modified to make our meaning clearer.
Go ahead and we'll give them the context and then we'll come back.
Now, the last definition, forest land, is the same as our present statute 477001.
Didn't cause any problem.
No, I'm not aware of. We couldn't find any cases in which there's been any problem on that. Now, section 2 of the draft, appearing on page 4, defines reckless burning. A person commits a crime of reckless burning if he recklessly damages property of another by, one, intentionally starting a fire or causing an explosion, or permitting fire to escape from land in his custody or control. Now, the commentary on section 2 on reckless burning appears on page 5, bottom of the page. Now, the elements of reckless burning would be reckless damage to the property of another by intentionally starting a fire, causing explosion, or permitting a fire to escape from land. Now, this section deals with protecting the property from damage caused recklessly, where there is no intent on the part of the actor to damage the property, but he, quote, consciously disregards a substantial and unjustifiable risk resulting from his conduct. Now, that quote in there, would be as the term recklessly is defined in the Model Penal Code that appears earlier on the page, quoted in that section. And as we discussed earlier, some of these drafts, words such as intentionally and recklessly and other words of culpability have not yet been defined by the commission. That will be part of the preliminary articles. But so we were anticipating that our definition would be somewhat similar to those definitions that appear in the Law of Penal Code. Now, we've used the word intentionally, for example. New York uses the intentionally, Michigan uses intentionally, the Law of Penal Code uses purposely. They're talking about the same things. Now, purposely as opposed to recklessly. Recklessly, we used in our criminal mischief draft. But I think you can see that what we're driving at, the type of culpability that a man can get on in these crimes. Reckless burning does not come up to arson because there is no intent to damage. There may be an intent to start a fire. The fire, because of reckless conduct on the part of the defendant, actually burns the property or causes some damage. Or the fire may not have even been started by the actor if it comes under sub 2, permitting the fire to escape the land. But that type of conduct is presently prohibited by Oregon statutes. So we have picked it up under reckless burning. Now, as we go along here, we describe more fully how this compares with our existing law, and I'll get into that a little bit. And then we go from reckless burning into arson in the second degree. And here we have an intent on the part of the actor to damage property. Now,
yes. As I read sections 2, 3, and 4, we're very conscious of forest fires in our country, particularly this year and this after last week. A bunch of guys get feared up on the 4th of July and start driving through roads and tossing out cigarettes and shooting at this, that, and the other thing that would not come under any of these sections.
Depends on the definition of reckless. That's something I want to get into.
Also got the addition of intentionally, and a guy goes down the road gassed up and throws a cigarette out of the car. It was reckless, yes, but was he intending to start a fire? Probably not.
No, this that type of conduct wouldn't be classified as arson. I don't think it's not classified as arson now.
No. What's it classified as?
If you have a definition of reckless, eventually, that is similar to this you have set out and think that intentionally would not be needed there. Because the definition of reckless would include an intent. In fact, I would urge that you strike out the word intentionally, particularly in line with just what Bob was just saying, and then over whenever you get to the point of considering recklessly on the next page, did you strike out the word consciously?
On the next page?
Right, where there's the proposed model penal code definition of recklessly.
Well,
it says a person acts recklessly with respect to material harm of offense, but he consciously. And this is the thing that you never can prove. And I don't think it's necessary. When he disregards a substantial and unjustifiable risk, you don't have to show that he consciously did it, just that he just did disregard it.
Well, you're talking about negligence.
Aren't we in an analogous situation with our negligent homicide statute right here? Really, for all intents and purposes, the law places a proscription on the killing of another by grossly negligent means and calls it negligent homicide. And you have to prove gross negligence, as the court has just been through, I think. Here, what we're talking about really is gross negligent burning, isn't it?
Well, no, not exactly. Now, the Model Penal Code draws a definite distinction between negligence and recklessness. Now, recklessness is more analogous to our definition of wantonness. Wantonness is our present code.
I'm afraid what Gordon's suggesting, maybe I should have kept the mouth shut the first place. It broadens the thing too much. If we remove intent altogether,
my point is, Bob, I don't want to labor the thing, but and whenever you get to the point where you consider these definitions, as you have on the next page there, a person acts recklessly with respect to a material element of the offense when he, in other words, consciously, when he disregards a substantial and unjustifiable risk. Now, if you put in there consciously, then the illustration that you presented, you just would never be able to prove that this man consciously. How do you prove conscience?
How do you instruct the jury on
really
the elements of the crime?
Well, this would be the same as really a definition of gross negligence. Substantially. And you don't need, in gross negligence, you don't need to prove that the person consciously did it. But what you have to prove is that, in a sense, he was aware that, for instance, here's a stoplight against me, or that the speed limit is 30 miles an hour and I'm driving 80 miles an hour. You don't need to prove that he consciously was aware that I'm going to hurt somebody.
Yeah, prove that he knew or should have known.
He should have known.
His conduct showed a conscious.
Right. So that he should have barred. You drive through the woods in eastern Oregon right now, and you throw a cigar out. You can be damn well aware that the likelihood of starting a fire is pretty great.
Well, that's the two-pronged effect of the present instruction, where you knew or should have known, and the question is with attention to the word consciously, if you'd be able to instruct on the second part of that he should have known, but could instruct that he have or find the defendant guilty, you must find that he knew that, not knew or should have known. And certainly I consciously was there, I'd take it up if a judge instructed or should have known.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the point, it's a very valid point. This is a proposed alternative. No. This is the definition that the Model Penal Code uses, and which I suppose the committee, subcommittee on general articles, would be considered. Is that right?
Yeah, right. This is terms such as intentionally and recklessly certainly going to be defined. But as we discussed when we went over the burglary and trespass. Criminal mischief grounds. As we look at the present Oregon law, we're trying to talk about apples and oranges because we're using different terms,
yeah.
And it's difficult to correlate these sometimes. But as we look at what we're trying to, the kind of culpability that we're driving at, that within the context of our drafts, and strictly when we're talking about fairly serious crimes, it seems to me that the definition of reckless was more in line with the kind of culpability we're talking about in our present Oregon statutes in terms of wantonness rather than negligence. Now
let me ask something.
The Model Penal Code also defines negligence. I mean, you can see that there's quite a difference between
the commentary on Section 2 really makes things pretty clear. As far as reckless burning is concerned, which is what the point I was making, I presume that this becomes a part of the legislative history of the thing, why it would pretty well cover the.
What you're saying here on the bottom of page 5 of the commentary is that the elements of this crime, the crime of reckless burning, insofar sub 1 is concerned, as by reckless damage to property of another by intentionally starting a fire or causing exposure.
Intentionally and reckless just don't go together.
Well, they don't, and I'll tell you, we recognize that in our draft on criminal mischief, where we made intentional damage one subdivision and reckless damage another subdivision. So, recognizing the distinction there, if we have reckless modifying intentional here in sub 1 of section 2, we get an anomaly.
Why couldn't you just strike out intentionally? As long as you have the word recklessly in there, and eventually recklessly will be defined.
And of course, it has as it's defined, it picks up an element of consciousness also. So
right.
You get
right.
It, you in well, a sense seem to have said twice, intentionally and consciously, you did something or other, but you did it recklessly, and that. A little, as you say, it's an anomaly a little bit in the usual understanding of the word.
Of course, we're not saying here that he intentionally damaged property. We're saying he intentionally started the fire.
But what I mean is by the time you have consciously disregarded and intentionally performed an act, it seems to me a lot of people would say, well, that isn't what is normally considered to be recklessness. You've got too much
right.
Mental process involved in this to be an accidental or inadvertent act.
In criminal mischief, we may intentional damage of a higher degree of culpability than reckless damage.
Here we say, in order to be reckless, he has to intentionally start something or permit the fire to escape from the land in his custody and control.
And we could improve this by striking recklessly and having intentionally starting the fire causing an explosion on the one hand, or recklessly committing fire. It has to be separated.
What would happen if you strike intentionally from sub 1 and subsection 2? You recklessly damage property of another by starting a fire causing an explosion.
Well, now, have you all read the text of these other drafts, the model penal code?
Maybe you suggested that we should go on and then come back.
Well, let me read to you what sub 2 of section 220 of the model penal code. They refer to it as reckless burning or exploding. A person commits a felony in the third degree if he purposely starts a fire or causes an explosion, whether on his own property or another's, and thereby recklessly places another person in danger of death or bodily injury, or places a building or occupied structure of another in danger of damage or destruction. Now, when they use purposely there, they were talking about purposely rather than accidentally starting a fire. They're not talking about intentionally damaging the property. They're saying that he purposely started the fire. Now, what we've done here, we've said the same thing, except we've used intentionally rather than purposely, and then we've also brought in coverage that is included in one of our statutes now. It's not part of arson, but it's punishable by imprisonment. And that is more of a negligent type of conduct where it doesn't necessarily involve an intentional starting of a fire, but it might be fire has been started, then this individual, this actor, has a responsibility because it's in the land and his custody or control, and he recklessly damages property by allowing this fire to escape. Now, I don't mean to quarrel about these terms, but I just want to make sure everybody understands it, and you don't misunderstand what, when we talk about intentionally, we're not talking about culpability, we're talking about the act of starting the fire.
Is that intentionally supposed to modify causing an explosion?
Yes.
Supposed to modify starting or causing
both.
I apologize for not doing my homework, but do we have further than a section to compare with the Model Penal Code 220.2? Causing a catastrophe?
No. that would cover the as written here, would cover the forest fire thing, and contains 2 degrees, purposely or knowingly, and a felony of 3rd degree if he does so recklessly. This would take care of the kid who shoots 30-06 into a tank car full of chlorine at the edge of the Sunset Yard or something like that, too.
Well, that would have been.
Now, that has not been included as arson, and although the model penal code has put it in the same general article, they're not necessarily talking about arson.
No, they're going to property destruction.
No.
We know. To respond to the question that you asked a moment ago, which is solving things like legal intention of it, I don't think it would, because then it could make a crime if I started a fire on my own property and it got away from me.
But
you have to just, assuming you define recklessly, you see, you just go out and burn some trash in your backyard, as you do every day, we'll say. This is one thing, but if you do it when there's a strong wind blowing and everything is dry and so on, and you know very well that if you let this get away from you just a minute, you're going to have a whole neighborhood on fire.
Then go in the house and make a beer.
Right.
Well, why don't you just say, if he damages property of another by recklessly starting a fire or causing an explosion, or recklessly permitting the fire to escape from, or from us, that recklessly wouldn't be proper in sub 2. What I keep coming back to, Don, is this. I happen to think that our current 164.070 statute on this sort of thing is a pretty darn good statute.
How does it reach?
Well, it's in four sections, but it says and the crimes, they're misdemeanors, but it says the following offenses are punishable by a fine not less than 25 or more than 500, or by imprisonment in the county jail for not less than 10 days or more than 90 days. 1. Unlawfully setting on fire or causing to be set on fire any grass, grain, stubble, or other material being or growing on any land in the state. 2. Willfully or negligently allowing fire to escape from one's own land or land which is in possession or control. 3. Accidentally setting any fire on one's own land or the land of another, and allowing it to escape from control without extinguishing it or using every possible effort to do so. 4. Having knowledge of the fire burning on one's own land or land which is in possession or control, and failing or neglecting to make every possible effort to extinguish the same, regardless of whether or not one is responsible for the starting or existence thereof. Kind of hard to understand it by just hearing it and not looking at it.
Without necessarily subscribing to the way that statute is drafted, there you can see that the same statute talks in terms of willful conduct and negligence.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
And the leeway and the punishment is what they intend. I would guess that this, how you view this, has to do with how serious you think the crime is, or the offense is. And I just happen to think, I guess, that if I'm carelessly with fire, that may burn your house down, or your airplane, whatever it may be, but it's a damn serious offense.
Much more serious than is provided here.
Right.
Well, you look back, of course, to the civil remedy, if it's a person with assets,
mm-hmm.
but tremendous. What are you going to do with 90% of the people who don't have enough assets to cover them? You know, that fire out in the OSHA code last weekend cost something like $300,000 to put out.
Mm-hmm.
And
The Oxbow went 600,000. Or 900,000, I guess it was.
Plus the damage itself.
Plus the damage itself, just the cost of extinguishing and trying to control it.
You got double damage and the treble damage statutes against the people responsible. That's what Spalding is doing right now.
But you don't always have Tom Zeller back or somebody like that.
The railroad is easy to get even with, but the careless camper is a different.
You also have, don't you, the social utility of discouraging that kind of conduct by what appears to be the most effective sanction against it, that civil liability, where with a careless camper, whether perhaps the criminal one is the more suitable.
Well, Kathleen is saying that we don't want to put the state of Oregon firmly on the side of Smokey Bear.
Well, of course, I'm not proposing by any of these sanctions to repeal any of these statutes of providing.
No, I realize that.
Don't do that until I finish my case. But
could we do this? Could we go on and see how this all fits together before we
chalk it up anymore? There isn't anything to do with utilities.
No, there's no utilities.
All right, well, let's go ahead.
And you won't see utilities mentioned in any subsequent draft.
All right. All right, let's go ahead and we'll come back.
All right, now arson in the second degree. Now here we're talking about willful conduct, intentional damaging, and here I brought in and placed within the basic framework of arson the intentional starting of a forest fire. Now, under our present statutes, it isn't in so many words arson, although starting a forest fire would come within the prohibitions of third degree arson now, although there's a special statute under Chapter 477 dealing with the intentional starting of a forest fire, which at one time did appear as a separate section over in the present chapter on arson. But I know that, that although it's not set out in the statute now as that burning of a forest or starting a forest fire is third degree arson, it falls within the class of property that would be prohibited